Chapter 51. Within a month after the retreat, all the cities of Illinois were filled by the most humiliating clamors against Bishop O'Regan. Numerous articles appeared in the principal papers, signed by the most respectable names, accusing him of theft, simony, and perjury. Bitter complaints came from almost every congregation. "He has stolen the beautiful and costly vestments we bought for our church," cried the French Canadians of Chicago. "He has swindled us out of a fine lot given us to build our church, sold it for $40,000 and pocketed the money for his own private use without giving us any notice," said the Germans. "His thirst for money is so great," said the whole Catholic people of Illinois, "that he is selling even the bones of the dead to fill his treasures." I had not forgotten the bold attempt of the bishop to wrench my little property from my hands on his first visit to my colony, but I had hoped that this act was an isolated and exceptional case in the life of my superior, and I did not whisper a word of it to anybody. I began to think differently, however. I had hoped these reports were exaggerations, and the clamor against the bishop would soon die out. However, the outcry grew louder with each passing day. I determined to go to Chicago and see for myself. I went directly to the French Canadian Church. To my unspeakable dismay, it was true. The bishop had stolen their vestments for his own personal use. The outrage of my fellow countrymen knew no bounds. Several spoke of prosecuting him before the civil courts. There was even talk of mobbing and insulting him publicly in the streets, or even in his palace. The only way I could appease them was to promise to go to his lordship and ask to have these vestments restored. My next stop was the Roman Catholic graveyard. On the way, I met a great many cartloads of sand. At the very door of the consecrated spot, I found three carts just leaving the grounds. I obtained permission from the driver to search the sand to see if there were not some bones. I could not find any in the first cart, but, to my horror and shame, I found the lower jaw of a child in the second, and part of the bones of an arm and almost the whole foot of a human being in the third cart. I politely requested to know where they had dug the sand. To my unspeakable regret and shame, I found that the bishop had told an unmitigated falsehood. To appease the public indignation against his sacrilegious trade, he had published that he was selling only the sand which was outside his offense. In order to make his case good, he had ordered the old fence replaced by a new one many feet inside the old one. To make matters worse, the bishop had received that piece of land from the city for a burial ground only after he had taken a solemn oath to use it only for burying the dead. Every load of sand sold, then, was not only an act of simony, but the breaking of a solemn oath. I then went directly to the bishop to fulfill the promise I had made to the French Canadians. It didn't take me long to realize that my request would not be well received. However, I thought it my duty to do all in my power to open the eyes of my bishop to the pit he was digging for himself and for all us Catholics by his conduct. "My lord," I said, "I shall not surprise your lordship when I tell you that all the true Catholics of Illinois are filled with sorrow by the articles they find every day in the press against their bishop. Yes, yes, he abruptly replied. The good Catholics must be sad, indeed, to read such disgusting diatribes against their superior, and I presume that you are one of those who are, that are sorry. But then why do you not prevent your insolent and infidel countrymen from writing those things? I see that a great part of those libels are signed by the French Canadians. I answered, it is to try as much as it is in my power to put an end to those scandals that I am in Chicago today, my lord. Very well, he replied, as you have the reputation of having a great influence over your countrymen, make use of it to stop them in their rebellious conduct against me, and I will then believe that you are a good priest. I answered, I hope that I will succeed in what your lordship wants me to do, but there are two things to be done in order to secure my success. What are they? Quickly asked the bishop. The first is that your lordship give back the fine church vestments which you have taken from the French Canadian congregation of Chicago. The second is that your lordship abstain absolutely from this day to steal the sand of the burying ground which covers the tombs of the dead. The bishop, striking his fist violently upon the table, crossed the room two or three times, then turning towards me and pointing his finger in my face, he exclaimed with indescribable rage, Now I see the truth of what Mr. Spink told me. You are not only my bitterest enemy, but you are at the head of my enemies. You take sides with them against me. You approve of their libelous writings against me. I will never give back those church vestments. They are mine, as the French Canadian church is mine. Do you not know that the ground on which the churches are built, as well as the churches themselves, and all that belongs to the church belongs to the bishop? Was it not a burning shame to use those fine vestments in a poor, miserable church of Chicago, when the bishop of that important city was covered with rags? It was in the interest of the episcopal dignity that I ordered those rich and splendid vestments, which were mine by law, to be transferred from that small and insignificant congregation to my cathedral of St. Mary. And if you had an ounce of respect for your bishop, Mr. Chiniki, you would immediately go to your countrymen and put a stop to their murmurs and slanders against me by simply telling them that I have taken what was mine from that church, which is mine also, to the cathedral, which is altogether mine. Tell your countrymen to hold their tongues and respect their bishop when he is in the right, as I am today. I had many times considered the infamy and injustice of the law which the bishops have had passed all over the United States, making every one of them a corporation, with the right of possessing, personally, all the church properties of the Roman Catholics. But I had never understood the infamy and tyranny of that law so clearly as in that hour. I answered, My Lord, I confess that this is the law in the United States, but this is a human law directly opposed to the gospel. I do not find a single word in the gospel which gives this power to the bishop. Such a power is an abusive, not a divine power, which will sooner or later destroy our holy church in the United States, as it has already mortally wounded her in Great Britain, France, and in many other places. When Christ said in the Holy Gospel that he had not enough of ground whereon to lay his head, he condemned in advance the pretensions of the bishops, who lay their hands on our church properties as their own. Such a claim is an assertion and not a right, my lord. Our Savior Jesus Christ protested against that usurpation when asked by a young man to meddle in his temple affairs with his brothers. He answered that he had not received such power. The gospel is a long protest against that usurpation in every page. It tells us that the kingdom of Christ is not of this world. I have myself given $50 to help my countrymen to buy those church vestments. They belong to them and not to you. My words, uttered with an expression of firmness which the bishop had never yet seen in any of his priests, fell upon him at first as a thunderbolt. They so puzzled him that he looked at me a moment as if he wanted to see if it were a dream or a reality that one of his priests had the audacity to use such language in his presence. But soon recovering from his stupor, he interrupted me by striking his fist again on the table and saying in anger, "You are half a Protestant. Your words smell of Protestantism. The gospel, the gospel, that is your great tower of strength against the laws and regulations of our holy church. If you think, Mr. Chenecky, that you frighten me with your big words of the gospel, you will soon see your mistake at your own expense. I will make you remember that it is the church you must obey, and it is through your bishop that the church rules you." "My lord," I answered, "I want to obey the church, yes, but it is a church founded on the gospel, a church that respects and follows the gospel, that I want to obey." My words threw him into a fit of rage, and he answered, "I am too busy to hear your impertinent babblings any longer. Please let me alone, and remember that you will soon hear from me again if you cannot teach your people to respect and obey their superiors." The bishop kept his promise. My Lord O'Regan had determined to interdict me, but not being able to find any cause in my private or public life as a priest to found such a sentence, he pressed the land speculator, Spink, to prosecute me again, promising to base his interdict on the condemnation which, he had been told, would be passed against me by the criminal court of Kankakee. But the bishop and Peter Spink were again to be disappointed. For the verdict of the court, given on the 13th of November, 1855, was again in my favor. My joy was short-lived when my two lawyers, Messrs. Osgood and Paddock, came to me and said, "Our victory, though great, is not so decisive as was expected, for Mr. Spink has just taken an oath that he has no confidence in this Kankakee court, and he has appealed by a change of venue to the court of Urbana in Champaign County. We are sorry to have to tell you that you must remain a prisoner under bail in the hands of the sheriff, who is bound to deliver you to the sheriff of Urbana the 19th of May next spring." I came very near fainting when I heard this. The court of Urbana was nearly 110 miles away. The expense of bringing my 15 to 20 witnesses that great distance was completely beyond my means. The very moment I was leaving the court with a heavy heart, a stranger came to me and said, "I have followed your suit from the beginning. It is more formidable than you suspect. Your prosecutor, Spink, is only an instrument in the hands of the bishop. The real prosecutor is the land shark who is at the head of the diocese and who is destroying our holy religion by his private and public scandals. As you are the only one among his priests who dares to resist him, he is determined to get rid of you. He will spend all his treasures and use the almost irresistible influence of his position to crush you. The misfortune for you is that when you fight a bishop, you fight all the bishops of the world. They will unite all their wealth and influence to Bishop O'Regan to silence you. Though they hate and despise him, there was no danger of any verdict against you in this part of Illinois, where you are too well known for the perjured witnesses they have brought to influence your judges. But when you are among strangers, mind what I tell you. The false oaths of your enemies may be accepted as gospel truths by the jury, and then, though innocent, you are lost. Though your two lawyers are expert men, you will want something better in Urbana. Try to secure the services of Abraham Lincoln of Springfield. If that man defends you, you will surely come out victorious from that deadly conflict. I answered, I am much obliged to you for your sympathetic words, but would you please allow me to ask your name? Be kind enough to let me keep my incognito here, he replied. The only thing I can say is that I am a Catholic, like you, and one who, like you, cannot bear any longer the tyranny of our American bishops. With many others, I look to you as our deliverer, and for that reason I advise you to engage the service of Abraham Lincoln. But I replied, who is that Abraham Lincoln? I never heard of that man before. He replied, Abraham Lincoln is the best lawyer and the most honest man we have in Illinois. I went immediately with that stranger to my two lawyers and asked if they would have any objection that I should ask the services of Abraham Lincoln to help them to defend me at Urbana. They both answered, Oh, if you can secure the services of Abraham Lincoln, by all means do it. We know him well. He is one of the best lawyers and one of the most honest men we have in our state. Without losing a minute, I went to the telegraph office with that stranger and telegraphed Abraham Lincoln to ask him if he would defend my honor and my life, though I was a stranger to him, at the next May term of court at Urbana. About 20 minutes later, I received the answer, Yes, I will defend your honor and your life at the next May term at Urbana. Abraham Lincoln. My unknown friend then paid the operator, pressed my hand, and said, May God bless and help you, Father Chenecky. Continue to fight fearlessly for truth and righteousness against our mitered tyrants, and God will help you to the end. He then took a train for the north and soon disappeared as a vision from heaven. I have not seen him since, though I have not let a day pass without asking my God to bless him. A few minutes later, Spink came to the office to telegraph to Lincoln, asking his services at the next May term of the court at Urbana, but it was too late. On the 19th of May, 1856, I met Mr. Abraham Lincoln for the first time. He was a giant in stature, but I found him still more a giant in his noble mind and heart. It was impossible to converse 5 minutes with him without loving him. There was such an expression of kindness and honesty in that face, and such an attraction of magnetism to the man, that after a few moments' conversation one felt tied to him by all the noblest affections of the heart. When pressing my hand, he told me, You were mistaken when you telegraphed that you were unknown to me. I know you by reputation as the stern opponent of the tyranny of your bishop and the fearless protector of your countrymen in Illinois. I have heard much of you from two priests, and last night your lawyers, Messrs. Osgood and Paddock, have acquainted me with the fact that your bishop is employing some of his tools to get rid of you. I hope it will be an easy thing to defeat his projects and protect you against his machinations. He then asked me how I had been induced to desire his services. I answered by giving him the story of that unknown friend who had advised me to have Mr. Abraham Lincoln for one of my lawyers, for the reason that he was the best lawyer and the most honest man in Illinois. He smiled at my answer and replied, "That unknown friend would surely have been more correct had he told you that Abraham Lincoln was the ugliest lawyer in the country," and he laughed outright. I spent 6 long days at Urbana as a criminal, in the hands of the sheriff, at the feet of my judges. During the greatest part of that time, all that human language can express of abuse and insult was heaped upon my poor head. God only knows what I suffered in those days, but I was providentially surrounded as by a strong wall. I had Abraham Lincoln for my defense, the best lawyer and the most honest man of Illinois, and the learned and upright David Davis for my judge. The latter became a vice president of the United States in 1882, and the former its most honored president from 1861 to 65. I never heard anything like the eloquence of Abraham Lincoln when he demolished the testimonies of the two perjured priests, LaBelle and Carsville, who with ten or twelve other false witnesses had sworn against me. I would have surely been declared innocent after that eloquent address, and the charge of the learned Judge Davis, had not my lawyers, by a sad blunder, left a Roman Catholic on the jury. Of course, that Irish Roman Catholic wanted to condemn me. When the 11 honest and intelligent Protestants were unanimous in voting not guilty. The court, having at last found that it was impossible to persuade the jury to give a unanimous verdict, discharged them. But Spink again forced the sheriff to keep me under bail by obtaining from the court the permission to continue the prosecution the 19th of October, 1856. Humanly speaking, I would have been one of the most miserable men had I not had my dear Bible, which I was meditating and studying day and night in those dark days of trial. Though the world did not suspect it, I knew from the beginning that all my tribulations were coming from my unconquerable attachment to my unfaltering love and respect for the Bible, as the root and source of every truth given by God and to man. And I felt as assured that my God knew it also. That assurance supported my courage in the conflict. Every day my Bible was becoming dearer to me. I was then constantly trying to walk in its marvelous light and divine teaching. I wanted to learn my duties and rights. I like to acknowledge that it was the Bible which gave me the power and wisdom I then so much needed to face fearlessly so many foes. That power and wisdom I felt were not mine. On this very account, my Bible enabled me to remain calm in the very lion's den. And it gave me, from the very beginning of that terrible conflict, the assurance of a final victory. For every time I bathed my soul in its divine light, I heard my merciful Heavenly Father's voice saying, "Fear not, for I am with thee." Isaiah 43:5.